students when they were given the task of preparing the kind of messages they thought should be sent to an extraterrestrial race. Because a model of the reciprocity probe had been physically present at Timo's announcement, along with some example plaques, it was little surprise to Dan that the media, and indeed the public at large, were more interested in reciprocity than Timo's far grander plans for an orbital observation platform and ultimately an intergenerational ark, capable of transporting a large human population to the distant and as yet unlocated planet known colloquially as New Kerguelen. The way Timo had structured his news conference left Dan in little doubt that he had wanted the public to focus on reciprocity, but the way he was talking about the overblown social media controversy suggested that he regretted this decision. The most interesting thing Dan overheard was Timo's repetition of his belief that staff at William Godfrey's GSC were responsible for what Timo called a deliberate smear on his public image. Emma reiterated her position that it didn't matter who started it. What mattered was how Timo reacted. Dan knew Emma far better than Timo did, and well enough to conclude from her tone that she firmly believed Godfrey was indeed responsible. As soon as Emma's call with Timo was over, he asked her why she was downplaying the possibility of Godfrey using dirty tactics. "What Timo wants is for this controversy to go away," she said. "That's his priority, and the whole thing is a sideshow, so I don't want it to drag on for any longer than it has to either. Everyone knows he's on a different page from Godfrey, and even if we could prove that Godfrey did this, it's hardly the worst thing that's ever come out about him. The way Timo is going, with all the big things he says he's going to do, he's really going to need to pick his battles. Jack used to say, if you're having doubts about a battle, it's not worth picking. And when we get to New York, Timo's hands are going to be full enough with Jack and Godfrey as it is. The last thing he wants to be doing is getting dragged into another low-priority battle on Godfrey's terms. Sometimes the high road is the smart road to take.
So why don't you tell him that? Dan asked. Why don't you tell him that Godfrey probably is responsible, but that calling him out would be playing into his hands?
Emma paused for a moment to think of the right words to get her point through to Dan. Timo hired me to do a job, she eventually said, and that job is to help him with some media stuff over the next few days and to protect his image against exactly the kind of thing we're talking about. He didn't hire me to tell him the truth no matter what. He hired me to help him, Dan, and telling him that Godfrey is probably responsible wouldn't do that. Telling him this truth would not help him. Not all truths are equal that way. Dan said nothing. Did I explain that right? She asked, taking a sip of bottled iced tea. I can't pretend I'm feeling 100%. Good thing my gig with Timo doesn't officially start until tomorrow.
Loud and clear, Dan replied.
If Emma had been looking straight at him instead of side on, she would have seen the glint in his eye.
C-65. Denver International Airport, Denver, Colorado. The members of the public the trio passed on their way to Timo's plane were, as usual, universally friendly and largely respectful of their personal space. Dan held a large bar of Timo's favorite American chocolate in his hand, a gift he had almost left behind in the car. He quickly caught up with Emma and Clark after returning to get it, and they walked the rest of the way together. Timo rose from a comfortable seat in his jet, smiling warmly to greet them. Dan took one look around the interior, plush but still surprisingly small, and was immediately transported back to the last time he had seen it, on the journey home from Italy during which he had looked down from above the clouds while President Slater delivered capital D disclosure with the four words he had been longing to hear for as long as he could remember. We are not alone. Nostalgia was perhaps an insufficiently strong word to describe the painful ache Dan felt when he thought back to the honest simplicity of such times, when all he had been doing was trying to get the truth out. Since then, the truth had turned out to be a lie, which turned out to come true, partially at least, and the weight of the secret Dan had selflessly kept for so long had changed him in ways he didn't like to think about. Lying still didn't come easily to him, but hiding the truth had become troublingly natural. While others, like Tara, could innocently laugh and joke about how good they were at keeping admittedly less explosive secrets, Dan could barely look at himself in the mirror. For 22 years, Dan McCarthy had seen truth and lies as polar opposites, black and white, with nothing in between. But for the past year, he had tried to make the best of life in the purgatorial gray zone where secrets were kept for the greater good. Emma reclined in her own spacious seat after saying quick goodbyes to Dan and Clark, telling them that she couldn't do the longer kind without running the risk of ruining her makeup.
"Just remember that planes are safer than cars and that Timo has the best pilots money can buy," Clark said, paying more heed to Emma's long-held fear of flying than he had in the past.
Emma, facing them from her seat, forced a genuine smile at Clark through her unease and waved slowly at Dan. Timo sat down, ready to depart. Dan then breathed the deepest breath of his life and walked over to Timo's seat.
"I wanted to give you this," he said, handing Timo the bar of chocolate.
"How thoughtful," Timo said. His smile then morphed into a look of mild confusion as he felt something stuck to the underside of the bar. Dan hurried to the exit, pushing Clark aside and stopping only briefly to look at Emma.
"I'm sorry," he said, blurting it out. "But this truth will help him, and if Godfrey really is covering something up, then Timo's the only person in the world who can help us."
Emma's mouth fell open. "He wouldn't," she muttered to Clark, with Dan now already halfway down the plane's stairs. She unbuckled her seatbelt, but Clark silently held out a hand to tell her it was wiser to stay put. Beyond intrigued, Timo turned his chocolate bar over and untaped the small piece of paper that was stuck to it. A note.
"I'm going to kill him," Clark grunted. He pointed firmly at Emma's seatbelt, telling her to put it back on. "Emma, I wish you didn't have to deal with this, but you do. I'll deal with Dan."
"Catch him," she said with a rushed nod, permitting Clark to bail out. For the next few seconds, she held on to a faint hope that Dan hadn't just put her in the worst position of her life, a faint hope that he knew better than to do this, and a faint hope that even if he was going to do it, he cared about her too much to do it like this. Those hopes, faint as they were instantly and simultaneously shattered when Timo looked up from the note after reading its several lines of hastily scrawled text. The last time Emma had been on Timo's plane, President Slater had spoken four words that changed the world forever. And now, with a look of absolute bewilderment that left no room for anger, Timo Fiori disbelievingly uttered four others, which held just as much power. It was a hoax?
C-64. Tech Italia News Studio, Milan, Italy. In a small Italian news studio, an experienced host was putting viewers' questions to the spokesperson for a speculative research division, which was one of many to have recently been consolidated into Fiori Frontieri. This spokesperson, Natalia Ricci, had been with Timo for a long time and was authorized to talk about whatever came up. Natalia was far more corporate and far less maverick in style than Emma Ford, but when it came to choosing people to hold down the Ford in Italy when he was out of reach, a safe pair of hands was exactly what Timo wanted. Despite the ostensibly tech-based nature of this weekly show, almost all of the viewers' questions put to Natalia so far had related to the content of the plaques Timo intended to send into space inside the reciprocity probe. Having paid careful attention to the heated social discussions regarding the probe, Natalia was ready for these questions and included all manner of detailed data points in her answers. She also mentioned some of the early crowdsourced ideas which had been voted to the top of the to-be-considered list, including images of things like full sports stadiums and people with companion animals. "But as Timo made quite clear," she said, "our focus is very much on the goal of establishing a reliable means of contact by including instructional materials relating to radio communications and things of a similar nature."
"And am I right in saying that Mr. Fiori is ultimately involved in every decision made on these matters?" the host asked.
Natalia paused to choose her words carefully.
"Timo is more hands-on than most people think," she said. "But Fiori Frontieri is not a one-man show. He has put structures in place to streamline previously cumbersome interdepartmental cooperation, and he has certainly never been stubborn in the face of advice from those he trusts. Timo would be the first to tell you that his most valuable contribution to space-related technological development by far is not his direct personal involvement, but rather the incredible levels of funding he provides.
The host nodded. And speaking of people he trusts, can you confirm whether there is any truth in the reports we're receiving that Mr. Fiori has recruited Emma Ford to assist him with his imminent appearance on Focus 2020? And also to deal with the social media storm which has surrounded his comments during...
Manufactured outrage, Natalia interrupted. Low-level analysis has strongly hinted that the breeze you call a storm was started by GSC staff, but Timo has since told the people who were looking into that to forget about it. These tactics don't work anymore, so at the end of the day it doesn't really matter who was behind it. Although, again, for the record, the data I've seen suggests that those responsible were almost certainly GSC employees working under direct orders from Chairman Godfrey.
And as for the rumors regarding Emma Ford? The host prodded. Natalia smiled slightly.
Chairman Godfrey is flying to New York with a plane full of expensive advisors and spin doctors. Is anyone asking him about them?
We'll take that as a yes, the host said. And unfortunately, that's all we have time for. Our thanks again go to Natalia Ricci from Fiori Frontieri. Thanks for joining us, Natalia.
My pleasure,
Natalia replied, satisfied with her performance.
And don't forget to watch the panel tomorrow night. I get the feeling that 5 planes full of advisors couldn't save Chairman Godfrey from the truths that are coming his way.
C-63. Denver International Airport, Denver, Colorado. When Clark reached the plane's door, he saw Dan running as quickly as he could. At one glance, he knew Dan had enough of a head start to render a chase pointless. Fortunately, he also knew there was nowhere Dan could go other than the car, and that there was no way he would drive away and leave him stranded. For this reason, Clark opted to walk slowly through the airport. The only thought in his mind, that he didn't know what to think. After a walk that felt at least twice as long as it had in the other direction, Clark eventually reached the car to find Dan sitting behind the wheel, with his hands on his face. His head wasn't in his hands. Instead, he was sitting bolt upright with his hands fully covering his face. Now, the only thought in Clark's mind was his wondering as to what Dan was thinking. After this initial mental movement from anger to concern, given the way Dan was sitting, it was impossible not to be worried about him, Clark's thoughts turned to Emma and the impossibly difficult position Dan had just put her in. He had no idea what he would have done in her situation, but the one thing he did know was that if anyone in the world could successfully impress upon Timo how important it was that no one else found out what Dan had just told him, it was unquestionably Emma Ford. Clark got into the car and said nothing. Dan did nothing to acknowledge his presence, and for 4 minutes the brothers sat in absolute silence, with Clark staring at the radio's clock, and Dan staring at the pinkish hue of his own palms as sunlight tried to get through the gaps between his fingers. Eventually, Clark spoke. Well? Dan lowered his hands and exhaled deeply. He hadn't been crying, but there were visible marks from the pressure his hands had been applying to his face.
It had to be done, he said, and that was all.
Clark opened his door.
What are you doing?
Getting a cab, Clark replied, his voice still deep but devoid of its usual intensity. Go home, stay home, keep your mouth shut, and try not to think about how badly you just fucked Emma over and how much trouble you just caused for everyone. Got that? Do you still understand how to follow basic instructions? Dan started the ignition.
This was the only safe way to tell him.
There was no safe way to tell anyone, Clark retorted, stepping outside and getting ready to slam the door behind him. That was the whole point.
C-62. Private jet, Denver to New York. Timo read Dan's handwritten note several times before he handed it to Emma. She scanned it, sometimes having to squint to make out the words thanks to Dan's almost non-existent line spacing. Walker and Closter hoaxed everything but the lie came true,
real aliens stopped DS-1. Ben confessed to us hours before he died. We did not know until then. Later, we met real aliens and they planted the third plaque. I have more evidence than you would ever want to see. Kerguelen Bolide is definitely a sign that something else is coming. Emma will explain, but seriously, don't tell anyone. After reading it, Emma glanced up to meet Timo's intense gaze. Talk, he said. Emma ripped the note into tiny strips, then cross-shredded it as best she could. As the plane began to taxi down the runway, she looked out of the window in unwelcome anticipation of her least favorite part of the flying process. Takeoff. Talk, Timo repeated far more forcefully than before. This time Emma looked right at him. Or what? She said, much more calmly than he could understand. I'm looking at your hands here, Timo, and I don't see them holding many cards. Emma, we are on the same side. I apologize for my tone, but you must understand. All I want is some detail. Dan's note said you met aliens, and they planted the third plaque. So it's real, at least. That's what they really look like. In a very real sense, Emma was tremendously relieved that Timo's response was of this nature. He seemed far less interested in the hoax itself than in what had come next. From my perspective, this doesn't change much, he went on. All that matters is, listen, Emma butted in, because I'm only going to say this once. I'm going to feel dirty saying it, but it has to be said. Timo leaned back in his chair. Go on. You are never going to tell anyone about what you just read. You are never going to so much as hint at what you just read. And if you go against what I say and turn this into something that's bad for Dan, I will snap my fingers and turn this into something that's worse for you than you could ever imagine. Like I said, Timo, I really don't want to say this, but don't forget that you're paying me a lot of money to be here because you're not good at this stuff and I'm the best. You already know that if you go into this Focus 2020 panel against Godfrey and Jack without me, they'll eat you alive. But what I also want you to know is that if you go against me, why would I do anything that's bad for Dan? Timo asked, ignoring the threatening undertone of the rest of Emma's warning. Dan has been nothing but good to me, and my association with Dan has been nothing but good for me. I can hardly imagine how difficult it must have been for him to live with this for so long. I can hardly imagine how difficult it must have been for all three of you. Emma briefly looked out of the window to think. She hadn't expected Timo to be so amiable, much less so philosophical about the situation, and her level of surprise was so great that the normally frightening sight of the ground getting further away barely registered in her mind. She certainly didn't regret her firmness. The stakes were so high that he quite simply had to understand that she was in charge, but she did regret some of her word choices. We need to get through tomorrow without thinking about this, she said. She then turned her back to Timo, moved her hair to the side, lowered her collar, and ultimately pointed to the small scar on her neck. If you want to know what the aliens said when they linked a communications cable to my neck the night before they planted the plaque in Salzburg, you'll stay quiet until we get back to Colorado. And if you can keep all of this to yourself until then, I'll take you to Dan and we'll tell you and show you everything. Timo grinned and shook his head. The carrot and the stick, he said, chuckling dryly. So basic, yet so effective. It's almost like I know what I'm doing, Emma said. This time Timo laughed more fully. Almost. So we're on the same page? You understand that we're sticking to the plan we had 20 minutes ago, which is talking about Kerguelen and Fiori Frontieri and the GSC, and not talking about Richard Walker? Timo nodded. I assume he's the only other person who knows? What are you doing to keep him quiet? He is, but there's no need for us to do anything on that front, Emma said. Someone else is taking care of that. She pointed upwards, towards the sky. Timo's eyes widened. But do you know where he is, in case you ever have to reach him? He's closer than you would believe. Close to Birchwood? No further comment. Emma said, grinning slightly for the first time. Not until you hold up your end of the bargain and stay quiet tomorrow.
I hate Dan right now for what he just did, running away like that and leaving me here after he told you, but he understands the stakes. For him to tell you this, there has to be a reason, and if you do what I say, I'll make sure you get to hear it.
So what did he mean when he said that the truth would help me, and that I'm the only person who can help you? To me, that sounds too urgent to ignore. Does he think we're in some kind of danger from these aliens?
Emma shook her head.
This is the last thing I'm going to say for now, just so you know, okay?
Okay.
They're friendly, she said. They said they would never intervene again unless they had to, and since they intervened at Kerguelen, that means they had to. Dan thinks they're leading him to the fourth plaque, and that it's going to tell us something. Something that's important enough to merit intervention.
Like what?
We don't know, Emma replied. Right now, Dan is just focused on making sure that we find the plaque before it falls into the wrong hands.
Godfrey's? Timo asked.
Emma lifted her bag from the floor and produced a small binder.
The very same. And speaking of Godfrey, do you want to get right into our prep for tomorrow? I have a strong idea of the kinds of things he's going to try to attack you on, and the kinds of things Jack is going to say to try and look like your friend. And there are some key lines you can use to disarm and embarrass both of them.
Okay. First, let me just press this forget button on the side of my head and pretend I don't know what I know.
Timo replied. His tone was lighthearted, but his concern about being able to move on was real.
As soon as you're face to face with these guys, you'll wish you were more prepared for what they're throwing at you, Emma said. And as unlikely as it might sound right now, you'll be too busy dealing with them to think about spilling this. So what we're going to do now is prepare for tomorrow as best we can. What we're going to do in Italy is deal with everything we have to deal with there, and what we're going to do when we get home is talk about this.
Timo nodded, then pressed the imaginary forget button above his ear.
Okay, let's do this, he said. Godfrey first.
C-61. GSC Headquarters, Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Is this absolutely confirmed?
William Godfrey spoke into his phone. He stood alone at his office window, looking down at the sprawling streets below.
Yes, sir, the voice on the other end of the line replied. Multiple individuals saw it and several uploaded pictures and videos. She got on the plane with him and they're on their way to New York.
Godfrey sat down and thought for a few seconds. He had long suspected that Emma Ford was advising Timo Fiori, and while this confirmation was anything but welcome, it at least presented an opportunity to react.
"Does that mean her house is empty?" he asked.
"No, sir. We have multiple local sightings of a Tara Ford, her sister, as well the sister's own personal social media posts and location data, which corroborate that she is currently residing in Birchwood. But can I ask why Emma's involvement with Timo seems to have come as such a surprise? You posited this very idea yesterday."
"There's a difference between advising him and flying to New York with him."
Godfrey groaned, frustrated as usual by the slow thinking of his underlings.
Ford hates flying, and God knows she doesn't need the money, however much he's paying her. There's a lot more going on here than you realize. They're either up to something big, or they know something big. Either way, I intend to find out.
We'll do what we can, sir.
Godfrey rose to his feet again, and returned to the window with a spring in his step.
With the sister in Birchwood, and especially alone in Birchwood, we finally have a weak link, he said. Now do your job and exploit it.
C-60. Drive-in, Birchwood, Colorado. Clark had far less patience than usual with the well-meaning cab driver's delighted surprise.
You're Clark McCarthy,
but he tried as hard as he could to be polite. He was pushed to the limit when the driver later grew curious and asked why he was going home from an airport with no luggage. Clark came up with the perfunctory but convincing lie that he'd driven someone to the airport and left the car so they could drive home when they returned.
Who are you driving?
The persistent driver asked.
Was it Dan? What does he think about all this Kerguelen stuff anyway? Has he said anything?
Listen, man, I'm pretty tired here. It wasn't Dan, and he hasn't said anything about anything, okay?
The driver nodded, message firmly received, and didn't speak again until Clark asked him if he knew the old drive-in.
Everyone in the world knows that drive-in, the man replied with a warm grin.
It had been a long time since Clark last arrived in Birchwood in a car he wasn't driving. He passively took in his surroundings. The sights included the indistinct turnoff that led to Richard Walker's secret home, and later the Proud Home of Dan McCarthy notice at the bottom of the Welcome to Birchwood sign. Once again, he couldn't help but wonder what must have been going through Dan's mind, both when he made the unilateral decision to tell Timo everything, and also in the aftermath when the magnitude of his actions started to sink in. Given the hour, New Care Grillin' Bar and Grill was far quieter than it had been the previous evening. Clark headed straight for the bar instead of the busier dining area. He saw Phil Norris sitting at the bar, his bar, and focusing on a newspaper's crossword puzzle as he so often did. Clark then silently signaled to the bartender with two fingers, indifferent as to whether Phil would turn around and see him or if he'd make it to an empty booth unnoticed.
"There you go, Mr. McCarthy," the bartender said, settling that particular issue.
Phil saw the two beers and turned around, expecting to see two people.
"Thirsty," he laughed when he saw only Clark. "You do know that drinks were only free last night, don't you?"
"It's my day off," Clark said, pulling up a stool next to Phil. Phil folded his newspaper.
"Did Emma's flight get away okay?"
"She's on the way to New York," Clark replied, choosing his words carefully. He was glad that Phil didn't ask any further questions and instead joined him in indulging in a full day of much-needed distractions. They ate twice, watched a few games on the big screens, drank a few beers, and played some cards with the bar's motley crew of Saturday regulars. It didn't make Clark forget what had happened at the airport or stop worrying about what might happen next, of course, but it was a better day than he would have had if he'd gone home with Dan. It was dark outside, and both Henry McCarthy and Mr. Bird had arrived at the bar by the time Clark finally decided to make a move, and he opted to walk home rather than get another cab, mainly because he didn't want to face another excited driver. The mere thought of going home had brought the full weight of reality crashing back down onto his shoulders, and it was hard enough to keep himself together without any more prying questions.
"Spare any change, Mr. McCarthy?"
a croaky voice asked from the side of the steps outside New Care Grillin'. Clark turned to see a rough-looking man around his own age, evidently homeless, but not obviously under the influence of anything but hunger.
"I don't have any cash," Clark said. "You want something to eat?"
The man nodded gratefully.
"Even better."
Clark quickly returned inside and told Phil that he'd changed his mind about going home right away and now fancied grabbing a bite to eat before he left. He had taken leftovers home before, so it would be easy enough to order too much and pretend he was full.
"Just you?"
Phil asked, folding his newspaper and picking it up. Clark pretended to look around for a lost dining partner.
I think I came here by myself."
Immediately, Phil's demeanor changed.
"Give me your card," he snapped.
"What?
Deaf as well as stupid, are we?"
Clark couldn't hide his confusion.
"Phil, what are you talking about?"
Phil grabbed the sleeve of Clark's coat and pulled him to the door. Clark could have planted his weight if he wanted to, but he didn't know what was going on and went along with it for now. At the door, Phil led Clark outside and pointed up to a security camera before motioning towards the homeless man.
"Do you think I zip up the back? You think I'm running a charity here and that you get to decide how to spend its money?"
"Phil, the guy's starving out here."
"Give me your card,"
Phil repeated. Clark reluctantly handed over his meal card, knowing there was no sense in holding on to it since it would be utterly worthless without Phil's willingness to honor it.
"You can come in for a bite just this once," Phil told the other man. "Just this once."
The man keenly hurried inside, patting Phil's arm in thanks as he went. Once Clark's wallet was back in his pocket, one card lighter, Phil smacked him across the side of the head with his newspaper.
"What the hell, man?" Clark protested, backing away. "Lie to me again," Phil hissed. "See how that works out for you." C-minus 59. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. This is just a dream, Dan told himself. The scene before him was familiar, a valley etched forever in his mind, a valley in Lolo National Forest. There was nothing and no one around him in any direction, and the only thing more unnerving than the absolute tranquility was his unprecedented lucidity. Dan had never felt anything like this, aware that he was dreaming but in control of his dreamtime thoughts and even his dream world movements. The closest feeling he could think of had come many years in the past, when he had dreamed of looking down at his sleeping body, but even that was nothing like this. This time he was experiencing a fantasy in first person, somehow both immersed in the dream and aware that it was, ultimately, just a dream. He looked up. He decided to look up, and there he saw the most awe-inspiring night sky he had ever seen. The depth of color was like something from an astronomy textbook, and the breadth of star coverage was breathtaking. Breathtaking, however, was an insufficient adjective for what came next. First came a sudden and total flash, less like the Kerguelen bolide than the full-screen camera interference that had been caused by the messenger's previous Earth-based interventions. When the brief flash faded, an extremely prominent triangle filled a small area in the central part of the sky. Dan made an effort to remember its apparent size, as well as its position relative to the waxing moon and some of the most immediately familiar constellations. As quickly as the flash had faded, it returned, and this time it brought Dan back to reality. "I'm not dreaming anymore," he thought, suddenly feeling very different. The next thing he was aware of was a cold and wet sensation on his cheek, immediately followed by a more general feeling of being freezing cold. "Wait, I'm not even in my bed." Dan's vision then returned as his eyes shot open, only to be temporarily blinded by a bright but localized light source. He instinctively raised a hand against the beam and was straightaway able to make out the shape of a dog right beside him. A spaniel, by the look of it, which had been happily licking his face until he came to. Dan repositioned his hand and saw that this was not just any old spaniel. The feeling under his other hand was that of flattened corn, and it didn't take long for his mind to fill in the blanks. The flashlight beam quickly moved away, allowing his eyes to adjust and in doing so to confirm that he was indeed sitting in a small but neat crop circle. The holder of the flashlight then held it at arm's length and pointed it back towards himself. The man's other hand, by his side, was holding a shotgun. The beam slowly moved up to the man's face, confirming what Dan had already assumed to be true but had hoped to be wrong. Dan closed his eyes momentarily and took a deep breath in preparation for whatever was coming next. Whatever that might be, he knew it couldn't be good. Because right there, stern and intense at the edge of the circle, stood none other than Richard Walker. Part 3. Second Contact. To one who has faith, no explanation is necessary. To one without faith, no explanation is possible. Thomas Aquinas. C-minus 58. Stevenson Farm, Eastview, Colorado. Uneasily, Dan watched Richard Walker and his flashlight beam heading off towards the edge of the cornfield and the cottage that lay beyond. The night sky was overcast, in stark contrast to the incredibly clear sky Dan had seen over Lolo in his, well, dream didn't seem like the right word. Nor did vision or hallucination or even message. Dan didn't know what it was, but his mind quickly turned to the need to record as much of it as he could remember. He began to move, shortening the distance between himself and Walker. This grew more difficult outside of the crop circle when all he could do was push the high corn aside with his hands, and because he had evidently left home in an unplanned rush, or an unknowing stupor to be more accurate, he didn't even have his phone to use its screen as a light. Rooster,
Walker's aging spaniel who had briefly fallen into Dan's care when Walker was abducted a year earlier, and whose animal instincts had played an important role in locating the precise landing spot of the messenger's force field protected craft in Lolo National Forest, ran in slow but happy circles around Dan, excited to see an old friend. At the edge of the field, Dan thought very briefly about running away, but he was in no mood to back down. He didn't consider it likely that Walker would have had a second interaction with the messengers, but pondered the possibility nonetheless. After all, Walker was leading Dan to the cottage, and clearly wanted to talk about something. And aside from this, there was a fresh crop circle in the cornfield. Dan saw no reason to fear Walker. Minutes earlier, he had been sitting in a daze while the old hermit stood over him with a shotgun. He knew that if Walker wanted to hurt him, he would no longer have been around to think about anything. As it went, by the time he reached Walker's door, the only thing he was thinking about was the triangle in the sky. When Dan reached the cottage, Walker was standing at the door.
"Something tells me I'm not who you came here to see," the old man boomed, his voice still as effortlessly resonant as ever. "But we need to talk."
"I need a pen, paper, and 2 minutes of silence," Dan said. Walker raised his eyebrows and tipped his head back, looking down his nose at Dan for several seconds before holding out his hand to invite him inside. A small table sat next to Walker's shoes in the narrow hallway, and Dan stood beside it while Walker fetched him a pen and paper from the kitchen. Dan didn't look at anything but the table, concentrating instead on his mental image of the moon and the prominent constellations he had seen minutes earlier. The image of the triangle was etched in his mind, but what mattered was its position relative to everything else. When Walker returned, Dan drew quickly while covering the image in progress with his other hand.
"What do you think I'm going to do?"
Walker complained. Dan ignored him. The end product of his efforts certainly lacked the precision and quality of the savant-like map to Lolo and the representation of the messenger's craft his hands had produced the previous year, when he wasn't in control of them. But it was a serviceable enough attempt, and he was satisfied that the skyscape on the paper was fairly close to the one he'd seen. With the drawing finished, Dan immediately folded it and put it in his otherwise empty pocket. He handed Walker the pen.
"Thanks."
Walker eyed him carefully for several seconds, then returned the pen to the kitchen. Dan watched him this time and noticed that his limp was much more pronounced than he remembered. In the light of the house, he also saw that Walker, wearing a gray dressing gown, had lost a serious amount of weight since their last meeting a year earlier. Rooster lay comfortably at Dan's feet, and Dan's moments alone in the hallway were long enough to bring back memories of the fateful night when he had walked the very same hallway with not just Clark and Emma, but also Ben Gold, who had just arrived in a panic at Dan's door to confess his part in the hoax and to tell them that Walker was missing. Dan looked along the short hallway to Walker's bedroom door, remembering how Rooster had gone crazy whenever anyone touched the handle. He thought back to finally going inside and finding an empty bed, only to later see the security camera footage of Walker disappearing in a 7-second flash of light, which coincided perfectly with the precise timing of the DS-1 launch disaster. His eyes also flitted to the other doors, to the other rooms he had searched with Clark in the minutes before Ben Gold drove home for the last time to fetch the box of hoax evidence he would go on to dump at Dan's house, before killing himself in the IDA building's parking lot. It was a nice old cottage, but Dan's memories of it weren't exactly warm.
"Come on through," Walker called.
Still feeling no fear, Dan accepted the invitation and walked quickly to the kitchen. Rooster thought about staying put in his comfortable spot beside the front door, but ultimately followed his old friend.
"The GSC is a grave threat to the United States of America," Walker said, wasting no time in getting to his point. "Godfrey is in charge for now, fine. He is a strong pro-West figure. But then what? Cole is already in Ding's pocket, chipping away at Godfrey's authority every chance he gets so that Godfrey is undermined and a Chinese appointment can fill the void."
Despite his face being gaunt and his skin pale, Walker spoke with all the verve of his infamous press conferences from years gone by. Dan didn't know why Walker was directing these comments at him, but he had nothing else to do but listen.
And as you well know, Walker went on, the GSC has an absolute monopoly on launching anything into orbit, be it exploratory or defensive. But why should we believe that they'll protect us? They hate us. After Godfrey's gone, if something bigger than the Kerguelen meteor was heading for Dallas or New York, something big enough to flatten a city but not endanger global life, do you really think they would stop it? Do you really think they would give up the chance to put us on our knees? And give it 20 years for the technology to progress, if they ever discover that something is going to pass close by or maybe even land in the ocean, who's to say they won't knock that something off course? Straight into the continental U.S.? Dan leaned back. And people used to say I was paranoid. And they were wrong, Walker said, because there was something going on at the IDA, just like there's something going on at the GSC. Why are you telling me this? Stick with Fiori, Walker said. I know Ford is with him, so you're all clearly on the same page. Fiori is different from Cole and that rat-faced, shit-stained Jack Neal, because Fiori's actions are weakening the GSC as a whole, and not just Godfrey's position as chairman. Billy Kendrick knows there's something going on in Buenos Aires, too, and I never thought I'd be on the same side as that idiot. You're not on the same side as any of us, Dan said. Your lies are the whole reason the GSC exists. An unfortunate side effect of halting Chinese expansion, Walker sighed. We do what we can in the moments when we have to act, McCarthy. If I hadn't initiated the leak sequence I set up with Cluster all those years ago, they'd be halfway to Mars by now. Walker then coughed violently for several seconds, as though trying to bring up something that wasn't there. Are you okay? Dan asked. Walker stood up and poured himself a glass of water, then opened a pill box next to the sink and swallowed a few pills. Slightly further along the counter, Dan saw a small cardboard box with several warning stickers covering most of the side. He could make out the word, morphine. Are you dying? Dan asked, not trying to be blunt, but not trying not to be. Walker almost smiled. Everyone is dying, McCarthy. Some of us are just further along than others. What is wrong with you? It doesn't matter. Dan wasn't going to get an answer, and, as cold as it may have sounded, this wasn't exactly the main thing on his mind. So what'll happen to Rooster? He asked, moving on to something he did care about. Joe should come straight out here if I don't push that button within any 72-hour period, Walker explained, pointing to a red button on the wall next to the refrigerator. Joe Crabb, that is, the only other person who knows where I am. When the time comes, he'll take care of Rooster. What do you mean, take care of him? Jesus, McCarthy, Walker snapped. Give him a good home. What the hell do you think? Joe and I might be a lot of things, but that doesn't mean we go around taking care of innocent dogs. But anyway, we both know that this is bigger than me. You can look at the airburst at Kerguelen as a lucky break, just like the idiots have always looked at Tunguska as a lucky break since a blast that large could have flattened a city, but we should be taking it as a warning. That's not to say we couldn't have been even luckier at Kerguelen. If that meteor had come in a few miles further east, right over the island, Billy Kendrick might have been out of our hair. Walker grinned at his own joke, the thin scar between his lips and ear more prominent than ever thanks to the paleness of the surrounding skin. But seriously, McCarthy, he went on, we're not going to be lucky forever, and the GSC isn't going to keep us safe when that luck runs out. Hell, they're working right now to turn the luck around and wipe us out. Kerguelen wasn't a warning from nature, Dan said. It was a message from them. Walker's bloodshot eyes narrowed in focus. A message about what? If they wanted you to know, you would know. Do you know? Dan hesitated. He thought he knew? He thought he knew it was a clue about the location of the imminent fourth plaque. But did he truly know? I know more than you, was the response he settled on. Well, I know that that crop circle sure as hell wasn't there yesterday, Walker said, and I'm assuming they called you here tonight. Let's just say I didn't come for the hospitality. Walker tapped the table and laughed heartily. His smile then faded as he looked at Dan, and his expression quickly morphed into something between sorrow and pity. I wish it hadn't had to be like this, he said. I wish we didn't have a president so weak that the only way to stop China was to push the emergency stop button we came up with all those years ago in case the Soviets ever got the upper hand. Call me sentimental, McCarthy, but even though I had to do it, I wish I'd picked someone else. I probably could have made it work with Kendrick, and he would have deserved all the mess that came his way. I picked you precisely because you were so naive and straightforward. The very traits that made it so difficult for you to deal with everything. And to be blunt about this, I don't think it would have even worked with you if Ford hadn't shown up to help you out when she did.
Was that supposed to be an apology? Dan asked, surprised to hear anything like it from Walker, but an eternity away from ever forgiving him.
Walker shook his head.
No, I just want you to know that I didn't fully consider the effect this would have on you. And if I'd thought for a second that they were actually real, I would have done things very differently.
I think it's time for me to go, Dan said, rising to his feet. Thanks for the pen.
Walker and Rooster both followed Dan out of the kitchen.
Do you want something for your feet?
Walker asked, noticing only now that Dan had walked the whole way from Birchwood in a barefoot daze. Dan shook his head.
Thanks for the offer, but I'm not walking a single step in your shoes.
Suit yourself, but listen carefully, McCarthy. I want you to realize that you have an emergency stop button at your disposal, just like I did. If things get dirty with the GSC and our country is in trouble, you'll always have the nuclear option of telling everyone what really happened. You'll always have the nuclear option of capital F, capital D. Full disclosure. I would do it myself, but I'm not convinced they would let me, and I'm not convinced anyone would believe me, no matter how much evidence I presented.
Dan didn't say anything. He knew that full disclosure was decisively off the table, and he certainly didn't need to ask who Walker meant by they. As Rooster lay down again, Walker opened the door.
I have nothing to apologize for, he said, placing a large but frail hand on Dan's shoulder. But just remember, when the time comes, neither do you.
Part 3. Second Contact. To one who has faith, no explanation is necessary. To one without faith, no explanation is possible. Thomas Aquinas. C-58. Stevenson Farm, Eastview, Colorado. Uneasily, Dan watched Richard Walker and his flashlight beam heading off towards the edge of the cornfield and the cottage that lay beyond. The night sky was overcast, in stark contrast to the incredibly clear sky Dan had seen over Lolo in his, well, dream didn't seem like the right word. Nor did vision or hallucination or even message. Dan didn't know what it was, but his mind quickly turned to the need to record as much of it as he could remember. He began to move, shortening the distance between himself and Walker. This grew more difficult outside of the crop circle when all he could do was push the high corn aside with his hands, and because he had evidently left home in an unplanned rush, or an unknowing stupor to be more accurate, he didn't even have his phone to use its screen as a light. Rooster, Walker's aging spaniel who had briefly fallen into Dan's care when Walker was abducted a year earlier, and whose animal instincts had played an important role in locating the precise landing spot of the messenger's force-field-protected craft in Lolo National Forest, ran in slow but happy circles around Dan, excited to see an old friend. At the edge of the field, Dan thought very briefly about running away, but he was in no mood to back down. He didn't consider it likely that Walker would have had a second interaction with the messengers, but pondered the possibility nonetheless. After all, Walker was leading Dan to the cottage and clearly wanted to talk about something. And aside from this, there was a fresh crop circle in the cornfield. Dan saw no reason to fear Walker. Minutes earlier, he had been sitting in a daze while the old hermit stood over him with a shotgun. He knew that if Walker wanted to hurt him, he would no longer have been around to think about anything. As it went, by the time he reached Walker's door, the only thing he was thinking about was the triangle in the sky. When Dan reached the cottage, Walker was standing at the door.
"Something tells me I'm not who you came here to see," the old man boomed, his voice still as effortlessly resonant as ever. "But we need to talk."
"I need a pen, paper, and 2 minutes of silence," Dan said. Walker raised his eyebrows and tipped his head back, looking down his nose at Dan for several seconds before holding out his hand to invite him inside. A small table sat next to Walker's shoes in the narrow hallway, and Dan stood beside it while Walker fetched him a pen and paper from the kitchen. Dan didn't look at anything but the table, concentrating instead on his mental image of the moon and the prominent constellations he had seen minutes earlier. The image of the triangle was etched in his mind, but what mattered was its position relative to everything else. When Walker returned, Dan drew quickly while covering the image in progress with his other hand.
"What do you think I'm going to do?"
Walker complained. Dan ignored him. The end product of his efforts certainly lacked the precision and quality of the savant-like map to Lolo and the representation of the messenger's craft his hands had produced the previous year when he wasn't in control of them. But it was a serviceable enough attempt, and he was satisfied that the skyscape on the paper was fairly close to the one he'd seen. With the drawing finished, Dan immediately folded it and put it in his otherwise empty pocket. He handed Walker the pen.
"Thanks."
Walker eyed him carefully for several seconds, then returned the pen to the kitchen. Dan watched him this time and noticed that his limp was much more pronounced than he remembered. In the light of the house, he also saw that Walker, wearing a gray dressing gown, had lost a serious amount of weight since their last meeting a year earlier. Rooster lay comfortably at Dan's feet, and Dan's moments alone in the hallway were long enough to bring back memories of the fateful night when he had walked the very same hallway with not just Clark and Emma, but also Ben Gold, who had just arrived in a panic at Dan's door to confess his part in the hoax and to tell them that Walker was missing. Dan looked along the short hallway to Walker's bedroom door, remembering how Rooster had gone crazy whenever anyone touched the handle. He thought back to finally going inside and finding an empty bed, only to later see the security camera footage of Walker disappearing in a 7-second flash of light, which coincided perfectly with the precise timing of the DS-1 launch disaster. His eyes also flitted to the other doors, to the other rooms he had searched with Clark in the minutes before Ben Gold drove home for the last time to fetch the box of hoax evidence he would go on to dump at Dan's house before killing himself in the IDA building's parking lot. It was a nice old cottage, but Dan's memories of it weren't exactly warm.
"Come on through," Walker called.
Still feeling no fear, Dan accepted the invitation and walked quickly to the kitchen. Rooster thought about staying put in his comfortable spot beside the front door, but ultimately followed his old friend.
"The GSC is a grave threat to the United States of America," Walker said, wasting no time in getting to his point. "Godfrey is in charge for now, fine. He is a strong pro-West figure. But then what? Cole is already in Ding's pocket, chipping away at Godfrey's authority every chance he gets so that Godfrey is undermined and a Chinese appointment can fill the void."
Despite his face being gaunt and his skin pale, Walker spoke with all the verve of his infamous press conferences from years gone by. Dan didn't know why Walker was directing these comments at him, but he had nothing else to do but listen.
"And as you well know," Walker went on, "the GSC has an absolute monopoly on launching anything into orbit, be it exploratory or defensive. But why should we believe that they'll protect us? They hate us. After Godfrey's gone, if something bigger than the Kerguelen meteor was heading for Dallas or New York, something big enough to flatten a city but not endanger global life, do you really think they would stop it? Do you really think they would give up the chance to put us on our knees? And give it 20 years for the technology to progress. If they ever discover that something is going to pass close by or maybe even land in the ocean, who's to say they won't knock that something off course? Straight into the continental U.S.?
Dan leaned back.
"And people used to say I was paranoid. And they were wrong," Walker said, "because there was something going on at the IDA, just like there's something going on at the GSC. Why are you telling me this?
Stick with Fiore, Walker said. I know Ford is with him, so you're all clearly on the same page. Fiore is different from Cole and that rat-faced, shit-stained Jack Neal, because Fiore's actions are weakening the GSC as a whole, and not just Godfrey's position as chairman. Billy Kendrick knows there's something going on in Buenos Aires, too, and I never thought I'd be on the same side as that idiot.
You're not on the same side as any of us, Dan said. Your lies are the whole reason the GSC exists. An unfortunate side effect of halting Chinese expansion, Walker sighed.
We do what we can in the moments when we have to act, McCarthy. If I hadn't initiated the leak sequence I set up with Cluster all those years ago, they'd be halfway to Mars by now.
Walker then coughed violently for several seconds, as though trying to bring up something that wasn't there.
Are you okay? Dan asked.
Walker stood up and poured himself a glass of water, then opened a pill box next to the sink and swallowed a few pills. Slightly further along the counter, Dan saw a small cardboard box with several warning stickers covering most of the side. He could make out the word, morphine.
Are you dying? Dan asked, not trying to be blunt, but not trying not to be.
Walker almost smiled.
Everyone is dying, McCarthy. Some of us are just further along than others.
What is wrong with you?
It doesn't matter.
Dan wasn't going to get an answer, and, as cold as it may have sounded, this wasn't exactly the main thing on his mind.
So what'll happen to Rooster? He asked, moving on to something he did care about.
Joe should come straight out here if I don't push that button within any 72-hour period, Walker explained, pointing to a red button on the wall next to the refrigerator. Joe Crabb, that is, the only other person who knows where I am. When the time comes, he'll take care of Rooster.
What do you mean, take care of him? Jesus, McCarthy, Walker snapped. Give him a good home. What the hell do you think?
Joe and I might be a lot of things, but that doesn't mean we go around taking care of innocent dogs. But anyway, we both know that this is bigger than me. You can look at the airburst at Kerguelen as a lucky break, just like the idiots have always looked at Tunguska as a lucky break since a blast that large could have flattened a city, but we should be taking it as a warning. That's not to say we couldn't have been even luckier at Kerguelen. If that meteor had come in a few miles further east, right over the island, Billy Kendrick might have been out of our hair.
Walker grinned at his own joke, the thin scar between his lips and ear more prominent than ever thanks to the paleness of the surrounding skin.
But seriously, McCarthy, he went on, we're not going to be lucky forever, and the GSC isn't going to keep us safe when that luck runs out. Hell, they're working right now to turn the luck around and wipe us out.
Kerguelen wasn't a warning from nature, Dan said. It was a message from them.
Walker's bloodshot eyes narrowed in focus. A message about what?
If they wanted you to know, you would know.
Do you know?
Dan hesitated. He thought he knew? He thought he knew it was a clue about the location of the imminent fourth plaque. But did he truly know?
I know more than you, was the response he settled on.
Well, I know that that crop circle sure as hell wasn't there yesterday, Walker said, and I'm assuming they called you here tonight.
Let's just say I didn't come for the hospitality.
Walker tapped the table and laughed heartily. His smile then faded as he looked at Dan, and his expression quickly morphed into something between sorrow and pity.
I wish it hadn't had to be like this, he said. I wish we didn't have a president so weak that the only way to stop China was to push the emergency stop button we came up with all those years ago in case the Soviets ever got the upper hand. Call me sentimental, McCarthy, but even though I had to do it, I wish I'd picked someone else. I probably could have made it work with Kendrick, and he would have deserved all the mess that came his way. I picked you precisely because you were so naive and straightforward. The very traits that made it so difficult for you to deal with everything. And to be blunt about this, I don't think it would have even worked with you if Ford hadn't shown up to help you out when she did.
Was that supposed to be an apology? Dan asked, surprised to hear anything like it from Walker, but an eternity away from ever forgiving him.
Walker shook his head. No, I just want you to know that I didn't fully consider the effect this would have on you. And if I'd thought for a second that they were actually real, I would have done things very differently.
I think it's time for me to go, Dan said, rising to his feet. Thanks for the pen.
Walker and Rooster both followed Dan out of the kitchen.
Do you want something for your feet?
Walker asked, noticing only now that Dan had walked the whole way from Birchwood in a barefoot daze. Dan shook his head.
Thanks for the offer, but I'm not walking a single step in your shoes.
Suit yourself, but listen carefully, McCarthy. I want you to realize that you have an emergency stop button.